A table of sandwiches, cakes, and brightly colored napkins sits in the center of the room. Smiles beam on the faces of every staff member as they help organize seats and spaces for everyone. Their ability to live in the here and now, to make this moment matter for the people in their care, is second to none. One nurse in particular looks like I do after a few too many. She's dancing from chair to wheelchair, holding the hands of each patient before moving on to the next one. A lady, introduced to us as May, is giving it socks on the piano, bashing the keyboard like she's the star attraction at Symphony Hall. Already some of the patients are singing along, bringing smiles and laughs to their families. My mom isn't. She sits in her wheelchair, looking around like she's just landed on another planet. May moves on to another song now. I think it's from a musical. Mom used to love musicals. Chicago, Singin' in the Rain. She always said Mamma Mia was her favorite. After hearing a few notes, I realize I know this song. Mom used to sing it when she was cooking. She told me her mom sang it to her. Moon River. I lean in, put my lips to her ear, and croon the opening words to her, hoping that she can hear me through the fog her brain exists in. Then, something wonderful happens. Mom turns to look at me, and her eyes open wide. I think she knows me. She does. She knows me. It's as if someone is kissing my heart. Squeezing her hand, tears come to my eyes. Happy tears. Then I notice her dry lips parting. Holding my breath, I wait, leaning in to catch the words as she completes the lyrics, singing in a small, cracked voice. Wiping the tears from my eyes, I feel a warmth travel through my body. It's like a present from an angel. Nothing else matters in this moment. Not Stephen Black or Detective Ivy Turner or Katie Collins. Just Moon River and Mom back in her own kitchen singing those words. After a while, though, Mom tires. She becomes agitated, twisting and turning in the wheelchair, making strange, squeaky noises, drooling. She looks scared, so I release the catch on the wheel and push her out of the room and down the corridor. I'm happy that I came here today. Happy I had that moment with Mom. Leaning over the back of the wheelchair, I whisper, "Like the song says, we're drifters, Mom." The corridor is much cooler than the overwhelming heat in the family room, so I decide to push the wheelchair around for a bit to cool myself down. When I find myself outside Dr. Riley's office, I see a notice stuck to her door. Clinical trial, information meeting in progress. What's that about? Shit, I'm probably supposed to be there. I must have missed the email, or maybe it went into my spam. Though I don't see how. I've been extra careful to read everything since Detective Turner ordered me to monitor my social media. I think I better go in and see what's going on. Explain that I didn't get the notification. I don't want her to think I just didn't bother to show up. By now, Mom has fallen asleep, her head tilted to one side, her breath slow and shallow. The blanket has slipped slightly, so I tuck it in below her legs and straighten her head. Then I move the chair against the wall and press the lock on the wheel. Tapping on the door doesn't elicit an answer, so I knock a bit louder. Still no answer. I open the door and stick my head through the gap. The room is in darkness, and everyone is staring at the screen on the wall. Dr. Riley is sitting sideways on her desk. There are four other people in the room, all facing the screen. No one turns around at first, but when I open the door a bit wider, Riley slips down off the desk and walks towards me. She instructs the four women, all of whom are about my age, except for one who looks a good bit older, to continue watching. I step back and wait for her to come out. "Rebecca," she says, looking confused, "what are you doing here?"
"I didn't get any notification about this," I say, pointing at the sign.
That's because I didn't send you any.
Oh, now I feel like an idiot. But then I think, why? Why didn't I get any notification? Is this not the clinical trial I signed up for?
Riley seems nervous, like she doesn't know what to say. She assumes a forced smile. I wanted to talk to you about the trial in person, Rebecca, but I didn't get the chance.
Well, here's your chance. Talk to me in person now.
Folding her arms, she says, Rebecca, we won't be needing you to take part in the trial.
Why not?
We have enough participants who are better suited for this particular trial.
I thought you said you needed as many participants as possible.
I'm afraid I can't talk about this right now, Rebecca. Can you call me and we can schedule a meeting for later this week?
Is it my blood results? Was there something wrong with them?
It's nothing like that, Rebecca. Please call me and we'll meet during the week.
Then she goes back inside. It's infuriating. Why can't she just tell me the truth? All this, see you next week, nothing is wrong, too many participants. It all reeks of deception.
What's going on, Mom? I whisper, as I push her back towards her room. The nurse is waiting to settle Mom back into bed when we get there. When she leaves the room, I sit down and pull in close to Mom. Holding her hand, I look into her glossy eyes.
What did you mean, Mom? Why did you say you took me?
She's smiling now. Her teeth look too big for her mouth.
Please tell me.
I lean in closer, brush my fingers down the side of her face. Mom looks at me, but I can tell she does not know who I am or what I'm doing here.
Mom, I whisper. I know you're in there, Mom. Come back to me. What am I to do, Mom? My world is falling apart ever since you said you took me. I slept with my boss. I robbed a bottle of gin from Maddie's. I haven't been to work in days. All these things that are so not me. Who am I, Mom?
But my words just float above her head like the rest of her world. Out of reach. Taking her hand, I kiss her cheek.
I have to go now, Mom. We're drifters, the two of us, I say, echoing the words of Moon River.
Chapter 24. Stale air refreshes me as I walk the dimly lit corridor of Maddie's. I'm looking forward to working. Staying at home doing nothing allows my mind to travel into some very dark places. Behind the bar, Brian is making a job out of wiping the countertop, rubbing it vigorously with the dirty gray cloth. It's like he's trying to remove bloodstains from a crime scene before the forensics team arrive.
How are things, Brian?
Good, Becca, good,
he says, not bothering to look at me. That's not like him. Brian always stops to say hello. Is something wrong? Please don't tell me Detective Turner is here again. Everyone gets so obedient when she's about the place.
Is everything all right, Brian?
I say, glancing around to see if I can spot Turner. Apart from the usual early birds drinking beer and ignoring one another at the bar, I can't see anyone who shouldn't be here.
Yes?
He's still not making eye contact.
Brian, what's going on?
Before he has a chance to answer, I hear Maddie's wheelchair behind me.
Rebecca?
Yes?
Maddie looks serious.
Can I have a word?
Sure,
I say, glancing over at Brian, but by now he's turned his back. Maddie doesn't say anything on the way to his office. His silence is unnerving. Inside, he rolls in behind the desk near the back wall and tucks himself in close. Should I take a seat or stay standing? Maddie is giving no instructions. Why is he being so quiet?
Rebecca?
He finally says, in a low, deep tone that leads me to believe this is not a prelude to good news. Leaning back into the chair, he taps the top of the table.
We have a problem.
A problem?
Some bottles have gone missing from the cellar.
My thoughts freeze. I feel like I'm going to puke. My eyes are locked on his as I pray for someone to beam me up out of here, for the ground to open and swallow me, for the building to blow up.
Do you know anything about that?
What will I do? Lie, Becca, lie. Don't lie, Becca, don't lie. No, I lie.
Are you sure?
He says. The room seems to be shrinking. I don't know what I should do. What if someone saw me? But no one saw me. They couldn't have. Maddie is probably questioning everyone. I guess that's why Brian practically ignored me. He was probably questioned, too. If I admit to this, I'm out of here. I'll have to take my chances. Yes, I'm sure, Maddie. I wouldn't dream of taking them. Maybe they were broken or misplaced or something. I sound stupid,
which is how I always sound when I'm trying to deny something I've done. Rambling on with a big guilty sign flashing across my forehead.
Shut up, Becca. Maddie turns his attention to the Mac on his desk.
It seems the CCTV says different.
He says, clicking open a file on the screen. Blood rushes to my head.
I try to stay standing, but I'm drowning here. Drowning in my own thoughtless actions.
Maddie, I'm sorry. So sorry. I don't know what I was doing. I thought maybe they were left over and going to be thrown out. I was going to tell you to take the money from my wages, but I forgot, and...
There's no point adding a verse to this crazy song. I'm fucked.
Please don't sack me, Maddie. I need this job. I swear I will never take anything again. Tears roll down my face.
If I had a gun, I'd shoot myself.
How could I be so careless? Stealing from the only place that was keeping my life in any sort of order. I am now officially a bad person. Maddie sacks me. He says he won't report the theft, but he never wants to see me near the club again.
It turns out he only checked the CCTV because Turner asked him to. She called in and wanted to see everything recorded from Saturday night, which is how she knew I left with Stephen Black.
Shit. Now she knows I stole the liquor as well. She won't believe anything I tell her. Brian is nowhere to be seen when I drag myself back out to the bar. And even Al, who I'm sure has some unsavory background stories of his own, isn't there to see me off. Out in the parking lot, I wave goodbye to the big old building and cry. What now, Becca Wall? What now? Jeff is going to hate me. Danny is going to judge me. Dad is going to worry. Mom, well, at least Mom, stuck in her prison of bad genes and good medicine, won't know a thing about it.
Chapter 25.
Not going out tonight?
Ms. Canister says, stepping out of the elevator, her red coat buttoned tightly around a velvet scarf. An explosion of perfume assaults my nose, forcing me to hold my breath for a few seconds while she moves past. Later, I say, not wanting to admit that I have nowhere to go and no one to go with.
She probably wants me to ask her where she is going, but I don't want to discover that even the oldest woman in the building has a better social life than I do.
Pressing the elevator button, I watch her walk towards the exit, her head held high, a lightness in her step. Ignoring the door to my apartment, I go straight to Jeff's. The sound of my knocking echoes through the corridor, begging, but I get no answer. Everything is still.
It's like the world has been put on pause and I'm walking through it,
searching for my space, for where I'm supposed to be. Back in my apartment, I finally confront what losing my job at Maddie's means. Not only will I miss the friendships and the laughs, but also the money. How the hell will I pay my rent now? How to pay for that big glass wall that allows me to spy on the world? I place my hand on the pane and look out at the darkening night. Shadows paint the buildings as couples walk hand in hand on the street below. In the distance, I see the red coat chaperoned by a gray suit.
Ms. Kennister and her date walk to the end of the street, then turn down Holden Street, which houses all the restaurants and bars, dreams and possibilities. The silence is broken by the rumble the refrigerator makes every now and then. It's beckoning to me from the corner of the kitchen, but I know it's just teasing. There's nothing inside. The only thing I ate today was a chunk of chocolate cake I couldn't get into Mom's mouth. Her eyes welcomed it, but she'd forgotten how to open her lips. In the cupboard, I find a half-eaten bag of Lay's chips and sit on the sofa feeding myself, hoping to hear Jeff's footsteps passing my door. I scrape the crumbs from the end of the bag, then toss it in the trash before looking around the room that 8 months earlier promised me a new life, a new beginning. It was supposed to be great. The new job at Bridgeway and King, the part-time job at Maddie's, dreams of a love life. One by one, it has all turned to shit, starting the day Katie Collins came to town. Switching on the TV, I flick through the stations, but nothing holds my attention. Nothing is more engaging than my own disastrous life. So I turn it off and go to bed. The following morning, I wake up, surprised that I've managed to complete a full night's sleep. I remember it's Sunday. Let's play Happy Families Day. Pulling the duvet around me, I close my eyes. I don't want to be awake. Don't want to face the music. After sleeping for another few hours, I pull myself out of bed and take a shower. I have to be at Dad's in an hour. Bert's front door is open when I arrive outside Dad's, so I walk over and tap on the door. "You in here, Bert?" I say. Bert sticks his head out from a door halfway down the hall. "Becca," he says. "Come in." Before entering, I glance across the street. Danny and Joanna haven't arrived yet, and Dad's house looks empty. Hoping I haven't come all the way out here for nothing, I check my phone to make sure I haven't missed a message from them. I haven't. Bert is in Edith's room, the room where she sat out her last few months in her own home by the fire. Her chair sits in the same spot, empty. As empty as empty can be. I know that empty. It's the same kind of empty that kicks me in the head when I'm at Dad's house. When I look at where Mom used to sit, where Mom used to stand, or where Mom used to sing while she baked. Two drifters. That same implosive empty. Like the whole world lived in that one spot and now the whole world has disappeared. "Is there anything I can do for you, Bert?" I say, knowing there is absolutely nothing I can do for Bert. It is his turn to be tormented by loss. There is no sharing the agony.
"No, Becca,"
he says, lifting clothes out of a bag.
"I have everything I need."
I stand there looking at him, wondering what to say. How can I take that broken soul look from his face? But I don't get the chance. As he zips closed the bag, Bert says, "I see the young girl who was looking for you is dead." So much for the sadness. It hasn't diluted his curiosity. "I know. Dreadful, isn't it?"
"What did the police have to say about it?"
How does Bert know the cops were talking to me? I didn't tell him. And how is he so sure it's the same girl who was looking for me? What?
"The police. I saw them at the walls a couple of days ago."
"The cops?"
"Yes. When I arrived back from the hospital, they were walking out in the yard."
"Was Dad there?"
"I don't know. They were leaving at the time, so I don't know if they got an answer." "Did your father not mention it?"
What will I say? My heart is beating like a late-night party, and Bert is looking at me for an answer. "No. I haven't spoken to him yet. Maybe he wasn't there when they called."
"Oh, well, his van was outside."
I'm ready to explode. Surely Dad would ring me and tell me if the cops called asking about me. He would. I know he would. He must have been down in the shed at the end of the yard and never heard their knock.
He was probably out back, I say, wanting Bert to stop talking about it.
I guess so,
Bert replies, placing the bag on the floor. I hope he didn't talk to the cops, that he didn't tell them Katie Collins was at my dad's house. Did you talk to them?
Who?
The cops.
God, no, Becca. None of my business, he says.
I think I better go, Bert. Dad is waiting for me. I'll call into the hospital tomorrow or the next day and check up on you. And you have my number if anything happens.
Thanks, Becca. It was nice to see a friendly face,
he says, walking me to the door. I'm sure the nurses are friendly, Bert.
Oh, they are, they are. Just not the kind of friendly you want.
Stepping out onto the porch, my thoughts are twisted. Did the cops say something to Dad?
Maybe they didn't get to speak to him. It's possible he doesn't even know they called.
His van would have been there if he'd gone to the bar. I want to ask Bert what time he saw the cops, but I don't want to bring the subject up again. But Bert will not let up.
Did you ever find out why the young lady was looking for you?
He says. I never did, I say, turning to walk away.
Oh, he says. I thought you might have got some idea from the note she left you.
I'm glad my back is to Bert, because my face has probably turned gray. That's it. The note. Katie Collins did not deliver the note to my apartment. She delivered it to my dad's house. Wherever she got her information from, it was not updated with my move to the city. Chapter 26. Dad's van stands in the usual place at the side of the yard, but when I get inside, the house is empty. I call out his name, but there's no reply. So I go upstairs to see if he's still in bed. If he's not, this is my opportunity to search for the note. The door to the bedroom is closed. With my hand on the handle, I slowly open it and peep inside. Dad? Are you here? The room is empty. A cool breeze drifting through the open window. A tall, freestanding wardrobe sits in the center of the wall. At the front of the wardrobe, a dark suit hangs against the door with a tie hung over the right shoulder. A black tie. A pair of newly polished black shoes sit on the floor below. My heart shudders, sending a shiver through my body. I cross over and take a sleeve of the suit in my hand. I see him. Walking behind the coffin up the aisle of the church, standing by the grave, tossing a rose into the ground. One last rose. One last goodbye. Is Mom going to die soon? I'm scared. Worried. Why is Dad getting ready? In the early days, before Mom took sick, Dad was always ready and waiting for whatever was going on. No last-minute rushes there, not like me. Mom said it was the army that had him like that. She would laugh at his efficiency, at how he spent so much time standing, waiting for the rest of us. But that all changed. Now there are days when he doesn't even shave. If the note is anywhere, it's probably in the kitchen amongst the piles of papers that seem to sprout from every counter. I hope Joanna hasn't done one of her mighty cleanups this week. If she has, the note is probably playing its part in a recycling center by now. My big secret, beginning a new career as toilet paper. Pushing myself through the gap between the bed and the wall, I stretch to close the window. My foot bumps something under the bed. I reach down to see what it is and pull a pile of newspapers from under the bed. My heart skips a chorus when I see Katie Collins staring back, her blue eyes focused, her blonde hair with its center parting. It's one of those high school yearbook photos, I think. But what a coincidence that the newspaper is folded open on the page covering her story. Even from the other side, the woman seems determined to find me. Only, it's not a coincidence. Taking the pile of papers from the floor, I toss them onto the bed.
Each newspaper is folded open on the page covering the Katie Collins story. What is Dad doing? Fear threatens to pull me to the ground. Does he know? Does Dad know I'm a suspect? I've been doing my best to keep this drama away from his door, but somehow it arrived, knocked, and got an answer. Oh, poor Dad. He certainly does not need any more worries. Maybe he's just intrigued by a local murder story. Most people are. It can inject a bit of excitement into an otherwise bored community. But I don't think Dad's like that. I shove the newspapers back under the bed, praying Dad doesn't know Katie Collins came looking for me. Then it occurs to me. The note? Did he find the note and recognize her name at the end of it? Did that send him into a panic, send him rushing out to buy newspapers? Or did Turner actually get to talk to him? Oh God, I don't know what to think. Surely if she did speak to him, he would have told me, or at least Danny. Yes, he would definitely have told Danny, and Danny would have called me by now. The kitchen is a mess. Mugs and plates piled up in the sink. A half-eaten block of cheese stands on the counter uncovered. There are bite marks in it where Dad didn't even bother slicing it up before he ate. The floor and table around his chair are covered in crumbs and bits of wrappers, and there's a loaf of bread going hard on the countertop. Things have definitely changed around here. At least that means there's a chance the note is still here somewhere. I check the drawers in the dresser and the units. No sign. Though I'm not really sure what it is I'm looking for. A piece of paper? Was it written on a card? I should have asked Bert what he saw, but I'm not going back there now. After exhausting the kitchen, I'm about to turn my attention to the hallway when I see a piece of paper sticking out from under a half-dead plant sitting on a little shelf by the kitchen door. Pulling a chair from under the table, I step up and slip the piece of paper from under the pot. My mouth is dry, stomach turning. I turn it over and read, "Remember to take your memory tablets." Mom's handwriting. This note hung on the refrigerator door when she was first diagnosed and able to medicate herself. Taking a deep breath, I start my still heart beating again. As I get down from the chair, I hear a key in the front door, so I push the chair back into place by the table and sit on it. Dad startles when he sees me.
"Jesus, Becca, you frightened the life out of me."
"Didn't you see my car outside?"
"No, I didn't. I wasn't expecting you."
"But it's Sunday, Dad. Where's Danny and Joanna?"
"They're not coming today. Didn't Danny text you? He was supposed to text you."
Dad crosses to the refrigerator and stocks it with the beers he takes from the brown bag in his hand. "Dad?"
"Yeah?"
he says, twisting the cap off a bottle of beer and lifting it to his lips. "I'm looking for a note that was left here for me. Have you seen it?"
"A note?"
"A friend of mine left it here with her number for me to call her."
"I didn't see any note,"
he says.
"When was that?"
"Last week."
"How do you know someone left you a note if you didn't get a note?"
he says, turning to face me. "Bert saw her leave it in the mailbox."
"Bert?"
He swigs some more beer.
"That old man is half blind. How would he know what he saw?"
"She spoke to him." With the bottle to his lips, he stops drinking and gazes at the wall for what seems like an age.
"I didn't see any note, Becca,"
he says eventually.
"Hey, do you want to go to Benny's for lunch?"
"Did the cops call here?"
"What?"
Dad splutters, almost choking on his drink.
"Cops? Here? What are you talking about?"
"Bert said they called here the other day. What did they call for?"
"No cops called here, Becca. Not to my knowledge." "Sounds like that Bert fella's losing it, Becca. Seeing things. There were no cops here."
"Are you sure?" Dad puts his beer down and turns his head to look directly at me.
"What is going on, Becca?"
His pale face scrunches up, looking worried.
Nothing, it's just Bert said.
Stay away from that madman, Becca.
I don't trust him. Never did. So you didn't speak to the cops, and you didn't see a note?
No, Becca, I didn't. Now do you want to come to Benny's or not?
But before I have time to refuse his offer, my cell rings. It's Bert. Edith is dead.
Chapter 27.
Pulling the duvet over my head, I close my eyes, hoping to get a couple more hours' sleep. I was with Bert until late last night, pouring him whiskey and listening to his pain until eventually he nodded off on the sofa. I hear knocking. At first I think I imagined it, but then it comes again. Someone banging on my door. I check the time. 8:45 a.m. It's a bit early for Jeff, but who else could it be? Turner, maybe? I hope not. Hoping whoever it is will leave, I tuck the duvet tightly around my neck. If it is Turner, she will probably leave, presuming I've already left for work. When the banging stops, I creep out of bed and tiptoe out to the living room. But when I'm crossing to the kitchen to put the kettle on, the knocking starts again. This time I decide to answer it. No point in prolonging the pain. If Turner wants to speak to me, she'll get to me somehow. Checking the peephole, I can only see the warped picture of an empty corridor. Whoever it was is gone. Pulling my bathrobe tight, I unlock the door to glance outside and make sure. The moment I pull on the handle, the door swings into my face, knocking me to the ground.
You bitch,
he snarls, his face distorted by anger. Red eyes, burning skin, teeth displayed like a pouncing wolf, he storms into the room.
I told you what would happen,
he says.
I warned you.
Stephen Black is scaring the life out of me. I try to stand up, but he walks over, plants a Prada shoe on my hip and pushes me down again.
Did you think you'd get away with it?
He turns away, giving me the chance to lurch upright. That's when I realize my bathrobe is wide open and I'm naked underneath. Tugging it tightly around me, I search for the belt that's swinging somewhere at the back. I can't find it, so I hold the robe closed and slip in behind the couch to protect myself.
You're going to have to take it back,
he growls, his eyes popping in their sockets. I have never seen anyone so angry. He looks possessed, like he could sprout horns and a tail at any moment. My body is shaking, teeth chattering. Blood rushes to my head. I don't want to anger him anymore, but I don't want to be a victim of his bullying either. I can't take it back, I say, in a voice I can barely hear myself.
What? What are you saying?
He snarls through expensive porcelain teeth as he walks behind the sofa. Clenching his fists, he pushes his face up close to mine.
What did you say?
I can't take it back, I say, louder this time.
You will take it back because I'm going to deny it, say you made it up, that you have a crush on me.
His eyes are wild, almost on fire, spit flecking his lips.
And who do you think the cop will believe, me or you?
He looks away, down to the shaking hands holding my bathrobe closed.
Me, the successful lawyer with an impeccable reputation?
Reaching for my hands, he grabs them and pulls the gown open. His eyes travel up and down my naked body.
Or you, Rebecca Wall, the little slut.
I open my mouth to cry for help, but the words are stuck somewhere. All that comes out is a squeaky, whining noise. I try again, but I still can't talk. I'm dying here. I feel like my soul is being crushed. I want to puke, to run, but I can't move. Sucking air into my lungs, I know I must keep breathing. No, please, no. I feel the heat of his hands travel down my arms, taking my robe with them. No, no, please, don't. I can hear myself pleading on the inside, but for some reason the words won't come out of my mouth. Please don't rape me. I fall back against the wall, as if I'm going to collapse, but it doesn't stop him. My robe is now crumpled at my feet. Closing my eyes, the noise of his belt opening screeches in my ears. Something inside me dies.
Get the fuck off her!
I'm frozen, unable to open my eyes, unable to move from the wall. But I know it's Jeff. Now he's threatening Black, but for some reason Steven isn't fighting back. As I allow my eyes to open, a blurred picture unfolds. Jeff, gripping the collar of Steven's jacket and pushing him out of the room. Jeff, with something in his hand. I think it's a gun. When the door slams, I slide down the wall, pulling my robe over me. My body has never shaken like this before. I can see it. My hands, legs, feet. But I can't feel it. Every part of me is numb. I don't cry. There's no point. Tears can't express how I feel now. I'm not sad. I'm broken. Jeff slides down the wall and rests his body beside me. He places his hand on mine but doesn't speak. Just sits by my side, squeezing my hand every now and then, letting me know he's there. Gradually, the fear holding my body hostage starts to evaporate. Heat is the first sensation I get back. It travels into my hand from Jeff's grip. Chapter 28. The smell of garlic is making me sick. Clouds of steam surround Jeff as he stirs something on the hob, making him look like he's appeared as the result of a magic trick. I have to eat. It's Jeff's answer to everything. I'm trying not to think about what would have happened if Jeff hadn't been going past my apartment. If he hadn't rushed back to his own apartment and grabbed the guitar tuner, which, held in a certain way, resembles a gun.
Spaghetti or linguine?
He says, opening one of the cupboards. Is there a difference?
Of course there's a difference.
Well, I'm not about to ask what the difference is because Jeff can go on for hours about food and wine and tastes and textures. Whatever you think. He looks up to the heavens. Maybe he's right. Maybe I'm not his type. Letting the room darken around us, we sit and eat the spaghetti, or linguine, I'm not sure. It's been 2 days since Stephen Black assaulted me and I haven't been outside the door. No one has called. No one has missed me. Everyone is caught up in their own shit. I thought Turner might call, that she might have found out something, but no, nothing. Do you think everyone has forgotten I exist, Jeff?
What?
Jeff laughs.
Why do you say that?
Well, no one has bothered ringing me to ask how I am.
Did you tell anyone what happened?
No, but...
Becca.
He says, turning to face me. He has that expression, the one he seldom calls on, the one he wears when he's about to say something serious.
Becca.
He says again, placing his hand on my leg.
It's time.
Time for what?
Time to get your act together. You've been wallowing in self-pity for 2 days now, and, well, it doesn't suit you.
It doesn't suit me? Has he any idea what I've been through?
Get up, get dressed, and get focused,
he says. He gets up from the sofa, walks to the fridge, and pulls out a big bag of greens. Bill and Hillary, Jeff's sister's rabbits, bounce to the front of the cage when they see him coming.
Do you still want to find out why Katie Collins was looking for you?
What? Yes, of course.
Right. Well, let's do that then. Let's see what Thomas Collins has to say.
Back in my apartment, Jeff waits while I shower, change my clothes, and put on some makeup. I feel better now. Not so much a victim, but I'm still nervous. It won't take me long to empty out this place when I leave, which I will have to do as soon as the landlord realizes I haven't paid my rent last month, and won't be paying it this month either. Everything is spiraling out of control. I need to find out why Katie Collins was looking for me.
Maybe if I get some answers, then I can start to rebuild my life. Jeff is suggesting I leave my apartment now and take his sister's room until she gets back, whenever that is. He doesn't know. I'm not going to make any decisions at the moment because everything is so fucked up. Let's wait and see what happens, I tell him.
You're very quiet,
Jeff says when we get back to his apartment. I'm worried, Jeff. Like, everything is wrong. What Mom said, Katie Collins, Stephen Black. My phone buzzes. It's Bert. Edith's funeral is to take place at St. Brendan's Church tomorrow at 10 a.m. Bert sounds shy as he asks if I'll be there. Of course I'll be there, Bert. Do you need me to do anything for you? Turns out Edith's sister Agnes arrived and took over. A whirlwind of organization. Bert said he didn't care too much so long as it's what Edith would have wanted. Flowers, lots of flowers, and a few psalms, her favorites, the ones she loved to sing along to. He sounds defeated. I hope he's okay. When I finally hang up, I see Jeff is flicking through websites on his laptop.
What about Friday?
He says.
We could go for the weekend.
Go where?
New Orleans.
New Orleans?
Algiers,
he says. Algiers?
Where Katie Collins' husband lives, remember?
How could I have forgotten? Of course I have to go to New Orleans. It's my best chance. My only hope to get an answer. Turner is not letting up. She won't tell me anything, just question after question. Well, now it's my turn to ask the questions. Let's hope Thomas Collins has the answers. I'm wondering why Jeff is so interested in all of this.
Maybe he just wants a trip to New Orleans,
but with me? Really, Jeff? The woman who's not your type? You don't have to come to New Orleans, Jeff. I can go on my own.
I want to go. I've been meaning to go for a while now, catch up with Winters.
Who's Winters?
A buddy of mine. Friday suit?
Oh, fuck, I have that stupid baby shower thing for Joanna.
Well, when would suit you?
I think about this for a while, then suddenly remember I haven't got any money. I don't even have a spare dollar to buy Danny and Joanna a gift for the baby shower, never mind a trip to New Orleans. Sorry, Jeff. I don't have any money. I empty my bag out on the couch. Lipsticks, ticket stubs, keys, a few coins, a few dollars. That's it. That's all I got, I say, glancing quickly at Jeff before turning back to grab the stuff from the sofa and stuffing it back into my bag.
Who said anything about money? I don't have much cash lying around either, but what I do have is this.
What's that? Jeff is waving a plastic card at me.
Air miles,
he says.
My sister said I could use them as I please. In fact, she said they'd go out of date if I didn't use them.
First thing next week, I'm going to New Orleans after funerals, baby showers, and whatever else God decides to throw my way. If I'm going down, I want to know why. Jeff also got us a place to stay, with some friend of his who left college the same time he did after the first semester, Hank Winters. He went to New Orleans, sang a few songs, and wound up buying a couple of dingy hotels in the French Quarter. Jeff was going to go in with Hank, but discovered that babysitting his sister's rabbits and playing the odd gig in the venues he liked to play suited him better.
One or two nights should do it,
Jeff says, before ending his call to Hank.
If we're going to be lucky, we're going to be lucky.
Chapter 29. The tall building looms in front of me, its spiral going all the way up to what looks like Rapunzel's tower. Rapunzel, Rapunzel, forgive me my sins. I don't like churches, not since the day the priest roared from the altar. He was bragging about some sort of miracle or prophecy when someone a few benches behind started laughing. The joy became contagious, infecting everyone around until half the sinners were choking into their sleeves in an attempt to feign despair. The priest didn't like it. He lifted his eyes and his voice, frightening all the younger members of his flock, including me. I remember that day as if it was yesterday. Mom tightening her grip on my hand, trying her best not to laugh. It was a poor attempt on her behalf because tears rolled down her face into the lovely new pink lace gloves she'd been given for her birthday a couple of weeks earlier. Nervously, I stood there, lips tightened, waiting for everyone who was laughing to disappear into thin air, banished by the Lord onto the devil's radar. You fear like that when you're only 5 years old.
"Stop laughing, Mom,"
I whispered. I didn't think she heard me because she kept giggling, her shoulders shaking as she hid her face in her gloves. Standing up on the wooden pew, I leaned in close to her ear.
"Stop laughing, Mom, or he'll send you to hell."
There's no reason to laugh today. Edith is going home. Her coffin is moving up the aisle to the pleas of "Nearer, my God, to thee." Bert walks behind, head bent, tears leaking from his frozen stare. Edith's sister walks alongside, accompanied by an old man in an old suit and two younger guys. They must be Edith's nephews. A few neighbors are gathered in the pews, standing while the procession proceeds. In the distance, the priest stands waiting at the altar. I glance around to see if Dad has shown up. I thought he might. The woman lived across the road from him since the beginning of time. Maybe he can't face it. The preview. Not able to stand here knowing his turn to walk up that aisle will arrive only too soon. Danny just flat-out dismissed any possibility he might attend. "I'm too busy with work," he said. Which left Joanna to appease me.
"If I'm feeling okay, I will pop down."
I wanted them all to come, for as many people as possible to be here for Bert. But it looks like I'm the only wall in the hall. No, I'm not. Here she comes. Well done, Joanna. Do not let that giant baby bump stop you praying for the happy repose of Edith's soul. Joanna sees me and nods, letting the cortege pass by before slipping into the bench beside me. Her hair is tied back from her face, her makeup only lightly applied. Joanna's smile is her best feature. She can beam as if a light comes on inside her head, and she's always in control. If you need anything done, Joanna is the woman to call, even now, even pregnant. Resting her hand on the back of the bench, she lowers herself into the seat, then leans in close to whisper,
"The cops were at the house this morning."
"What? Why?"
"They wanted to speak to Danny."
"Danny? Why Danny?" The toast in my stomach changes direction. What brought the cops to Danny's house?
"I'll fill you in later."
Joanna lifts her head to pay attention to the ceremony. I can't concentrate. Not now. I tried to keep the saga away from the family, but Turner is not letting up. Why is she dragging them into it? It's nothing to do with them.
"What did they say?"
I ask, unable to wait for the ceremony to end before I ask.
"Shush,"
Joanna hisses, making it clear that she's not going to have this conversation now. I'm going to have to sit here, listening to the priest tell us that this is how it was meant to be, that Edith has returned to God. The ceremony feels like it has gone on for hours, and yet when I look at my watch, I've only been here 20 minutes.
"Hurry up, Father."
Eventually, the coffin is carried out of the church and into the fresh air. Bert looks even older and more wizened than before.
"Everything was lovely, Bert. Edith would be happy."
"I hope so, Becca. I still can't believe she's gone."
I give him a hug and drift away to the side of the churchyard where Joanna is waiting.
"Tell me,"
I say, edgy with nerves.
"They called to the house just as Danny was about to leave. I was upstairs and looked over the banisters. I saw Danny lead them into the kitchen. I don't know what was said, but when they left, Danny was in a weird mood, and the cops were carrying a bag they didn't have when they came in.
They must have taken something of his away with them. I asked him what they wanted, and he said they were just doing some house calls in the area, asking if anyone saw anything suspicious the night that girl, Katie Collins, was murdered. He ignored me when I asked what was in the bag.
I say nothing, but I know Joanna doesn't believe him.
I don't know, though,
she says.
I looked out the window when they were leaving, and I didn't see them call at any other house. And they didn't ask to see me, either. Doesn't seem right if they were calling house to house.
Danny is going to be crazy at me. Blame me for dragging these people into his life. But I need to talk to him. Find out why they were looking for him, what they wanted to know.
I asked him what it was all about, Joanna says. But he told me not to worry, it was nothing. And then he left.
Where did he go?
Work, I guess.
Bert struggles to get into the hearse. I'm really not in the mood for going to the graveyard, but I will have to because Bert will notice if I'm not there. When the crowd disperses, Joanna heads home, asking me to let her know if I get any info out of Danny. I say I will, but I know I won't. The sky is dull with gray clouds as the cortege moves out of the churchyard and onto the cemetery. I should be sad, thinking of Edith, but my mind is consumed with worrying about what the cops were doing at Danny's. Were they asking him about me? Does he know I might be a suspect in the case? Or were they questioning Danny about his whereabouts on that Saturday night? I wonder what they took away in the bag. In the car, the old lady I offered a lift to is wiping tears from her eyes. I put my hand on her shoulder and tell her Edith is in a better place, that she's gone past her pain now. But these words mean nothing. I know that. Loss is loss. Grief is grief. Knowing someone's in a better place does not stop you wanting them back. Bert walks over when the ceremony ends, dark rings circling his eyes.
Thanks for coming, Becca. I know you're busy, so it's nice you took the time. Edith is grateful.
I couldn't have missed it, Bert. How are you?
Okay, I guess. I'll be better when this gang go home and leave me alone.
Bert nods in the direction of Edith's family, making me laugh.
I have to suffer them a while longer. They're all coming back to the house.
It'll be all over soon, Bert. I'm sure they won't stay long.
I hope not,
he says, turning to accept an old man's condolences. The world carries on as it did before. The sky blue, the trees green, the traffic a nightmare. Turning out of the graveyard, I find myself stuck in a jam, cars beeping like they have the code to break the gridlock. Thinking about Danny and the cops' visit is torturing me, making me fear all sorts of stuff. With one eye on the car in front, I take out my phone and dial his number. No answer. I dial again. Again, no answer.
Where are you, Danny? Why won't you talk to me?
Chapter 30. All the way home, I tried to call Danny, but with no success. He'll probably pretend he was in an important meeting and couldn't be disturbed while he fixed some issue the world was having. But I know that's not the case. We have a pact. Phone calls must be answered no matter what in case it's about Mom. With no other option, I decide I'll call to the house later when he's home. I spend the afternoon clearing out my apartment and moving my stuff into Jeff's. It's only temporary until I can get another job, then I'll find another place. Somewhere Stephen Black can't find me. Thinking back on that morning, I cringe. I want to throw up. Jeff thinks I should tell Turner what happened, but I don't want any more hassle at the moment. Turner thinks I'm crazy as it is. Which reminds me, I haven't heard from her in a while. She's obviously been too busy calling on my dad and now Danny. Closing Jeff's door behind me, I walk down the corridor and pass my old apartment. Should I be sad? I'm not. If anything, I'm relieved I don't have to go back in there, back to all those broken promises.
The screechy elevator takes me down to the lobby where Lenny is snoozing behind the desk. He scrambles to his feet when I call his name.
Everything okay?
He says. Yes, everything's fine.
Did you find out who was in your apartment?
No, but I won't be staying there anymore. The keys crash onto the counter when I let them drop. Lenny looks at me, mouth open like he's expecting food.
But...
He picks up the keys.
I'm not sure that's how it works, Becca. I think you have to contact the leasing company.
The leasing company didn't care when I was broken into, Lenny. I lie, implying I notified them. So they can do what they have to, but I'm out of there. Switching the keys from one hand to the other, Lenny looks at me, then back to the keys. I walk away, hoping he'll buy it, that he'll tell them I'm leaving because of the break-in. That way they might not hound me for the rent.
Where will you go?
He says. Not far. Lenny probably thinks I'm cool, but my heart is thumping as I walk away. Out on the street, I see Jeff, cradling brown bags in each arm. I'm nervous, wondering if I did the right thing. Will Jeff regret his act of kindness? Want me out after a week?
I might want out after a week.
It makes no odds, really, because no matter how much I question my decision, I keep coming up with the same answer. No money, no choice. Before Jeff sees me, I turn the opposite way. The next person I need to talk to is Danny. The weight is crucifying me. Red lines imprint my hand where I've gripped the phone all day waiting for the buzz that never came. I'm surprised, really. I thought he'd gloat over my latest disaster, take pleasure out of chastising me, counseling me, shrinking my soul. I know he cares for me, a lot. He always has. But he can also make me feel like a piece of shit when he's doing it. Danny's house is halfway down Ash Street, close to the local college, with a Boston Donuts shop on the corner. Which is a waste. Danny never puts sugar in his mouth. If you look out the bedroom window at the back of his house, there's a clear view of Tree Hill Park. Although, not the spot where Katie Collins' body was found. That was hidden in the forest, by the redundant bridge. Knocking on Danny's door, I realize that that might be the reason why the cops called here. Maybe they called at all the houses that have a clear view of the park. But when Danny answers the door and I see the stress in his face, I reconsider.
Becca,
he says, turning away without a smile or an invitation to come in. In fact, I think he sighs. How are things? I say, following him into the back room where Joanna is sitting with her feet up on the sofa watching TV. Becca, she says, smiling. Did you go back to Bert's house after the funeral? Yes, just for a short while, I say, watching as Danny attempts to leave the room. Danny, I want to talk to you, I say. But he puts his phone to his ear, pretending he's taking a call. Joanna pulls a face, warning me he's not in a good mood, but I don't care. I didn't come all this way for nothing. So I follow him into the little office he built for himself off the hallway. Danny, I say. He turns around, too casually. Danny, why were the cops looking for you?
What cops?
The cops who called this morning. Joanna told me.
Oh, those guys.
He picks up a sheet of paper off the desk, making out it's entertaining him more than I am.
They were just doing house calls, wanting to know if anyone saw anything the night that young woman was killed.
He puts the page down.
Anything else?
He says.
How are you doing? All set for the baby shower, I hope.
I'm not buying that. He's brushing me off, trying to change the subject. And did you see anything?
Did I see anything where?
In Tree Hill. In the park, the night the...
Becca, stop. I saw nothing and told them so.
Danny should be asking me why I'm so interested. Why I came all the way out here to find out what the cops wanted. Did they ask about me? And what did they take in the bag?
What bag?
Joanna said they took something away with them. Was it something belonging to you?
Why would they ask about you, Becca?
The sound from the TV in the other room can no longer be heard. Joanna must have her ear to the wall. I'm anxious now. Danny is staring at me.